have seen with our own eyes and our own lived experiences, the unacceptable, brazen, bold, organized retail crime that you just can't have in an ordered society. You can't have flash mobs going into a store and stealing, and it needs to be addressed.
California Attorney General Rob Bonta speaking at a press conference today in Sacramento, where a bipartisan group of lawmakers introduced a bunch of bills aimed at battling retail crime. Many of us have seen those videos of flash mobs descending on stores, and we've heard stories of targeted robberies at other places. That seems to be making California Democrats embrace a more tough-on-crime approach. And joining me to talk about this is Laura Cordy, co-author of the Politico California Playbook. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there are some 7 bills, I understand, introduced today. What do they say in total? What do they want to do?
Absolutely. I mean, this package of 7 bills that, like you said, a bipartisan group of lawmakers introduced today in Sacramento really aims to get at retail crime. But there's a key catch to this in that it doesn't touch Proposition 47, which is a proposition that voters passed about a decade ago, which, lightens some penalties for retail theft and some drug offenses. And really what they're trying to do today is get at these, you know, symptoms of crime that we're seeing all the time. These flash mobs, people have this uneasy feeling like there's a lack of public safety. And Democrats in Sacramento really want to address that. So what they're doing is a couple of things here. They're establishing a new crime targeting serial retail theft. And they're also, you know, making it easier for police to go after thieves, allowing them to make arrests without witnessing the incident or having footage of it. And the goal here really is to, you know, show that they're doing something without, you know, rolling back some of these reforms that they've made in the last decade that some would say, you know, are very progressive and, you know, push California towards criminal justice reform rather than away from it.
Well, so we have seen all those videos and they have gone viral, which gives the impression that there's just this uncontrolled and pervasive flash mob, robbery ring all over the state. You've seen them here in Beverly Hills and elsewhere, targeting luxury stores and others, and that gets on the nightly news. What is the reality? What are the statistics behind this? Is there really a big increase in retail theft?
Right. Well, you know, it's hard to, accurately kind of understand this. I will say that there has been an increase in some types of crime in the last couple of years in California. But far and away, you know, experts will say that the crime rates in California are not nearly as bad as they were in the 1990s at their spike. But really, it's been these kind of like high profile, high visibility incidents like the flash mobs that have really given way to this feeling of disease. And really, you know, I think given California kind of a not great reputation on the national stage, it's part of the reason that you have Democratic mayors like Todd Gloria of San Diego and London Breed of San Francisco supporting a ballot initiative to roll back some of these provisions of Prop 47, just because voters want to see it. Voters want to see that their leaders are doing something about these brazen acts, these brazen crimes that they're seeing taking place. So, you know, the reality is it's not as bad as it once was, but, you know, it certainly feels like it is.
Yeah. So these 7 new bills, as you said earlier, would not target Prop 47, but there's this separate ballot initiative called the Homelessness, Drug Addiction, and Theft Reduction Act. And how likely is that to get on the ballot and what would it do?
Right. So even though the legislature doesn't want to touch Prop 47, that doesn't mean the voters can't. There is a ballot initiative, as you mentioned, funded by some of the biggest retailers, including Walmart, to roll back some of these provisions of Prop 47. And, you know, really the key with ballot measures in California is you need a lot of money. You have to pay people to go gather signatures. It takes a lot of money to just run the campaign. Even if you get it on the ballot, we're talking, you know, upwards of $50 million for a campaign like this. And the retailers certainly have that money. So there is a chance that that ballot initiative could get to voters in the fall. We're seeing, you know, criminal justice reform advocates launch somewhat of a counteroffensive to that this week. But there's a good chance voters could weigh in on this fall, even if the legislature doesn't want them to.
Okay. And would it roll back most of Prop 47, which really reclassified a lot of crimes as misdemeanors that were once felonies? And as far as I understand, has been successful in reducing the huge prison population here in California?
It would not roll it back entirely. It's what we call it would reform it. And so some of the things that we saw were, lessening penalties for certain types of crimes. And what they want to do with this is, bring some of those penalties back. So it's not a complete dismantling of this landmark criminal justice reform law. But again, I think the aim here is to undo what some people feel are the ills, which is, make criminals feel more empowered, make criminals feel more emboldened to go do some of these brazen acts of retail theft. And that's really what they're trying to do, is just disincentivize those types of activities.
Right. And I understand it also would have a treatment mandate in it. So for some drug possession crimes, you would have to go into treatment or go to prison for a couple of years.
Right. And that's one of the things that, I think you'd have some criminal justice reform advocates wanting, right? There's always this kind of push to do rehabilitation over incarceration. And that's, something that voters might want as well.
Right. And are there any advocates for people experiencing homelessness or drug addiction who are coming out against this, saying that it would be too punitive?
I think certainly there are people who absolutely do not want to touch Proposition 47. Anything that enhances criminal penalties is always going to get pushed back from progressives, especially in Sacramento. But as we've seen today and, in past months, it seems like there are some Democrats who understand that we can't have this kind of blanket no increase in criminal penalties. We can't have this blanket non-reaction to what people feel like is an increase in crime. And so even though there's definitely going to be your hardline progressives who say like any increase is going to harm people, I think that there's just growing momentum against that kind of sentiment.
Right. And where's the governor on this? Because he hasn't wanted to touch Prop 47. What does he say about this ballot initiative?
Right. I mean, the governor, yeah, he doesn't want to touch Prop 47 because, he was a big proponent of Prop 47 a decade ago. And he essentially says, listen, we can do this. We can crack down on retail theft. We can crack down on crime without sending it back to the voters. And in his part, aside from, talking about the legislative avenues here, he has sent, police officers into Oakland. He has specifically dedicated resources at the Department of Justice for retail theft and cracking down on these crime rings. So he's using what powers he can to go about it without going to Prop 47. He has not specifically, launched like a campaign against this ballot initiative, but he certainly is not, supporting them and is not joining the other Democrats who are supporting them.
Laura Cordy is a politics reporter and co-author of the Politico California Playbook. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we will talk to the documentary filmmaker Rory Kennedy. She has a new film out about the Santa Monica-based group Synanon, a 60s-era rehab center turned 70s-era cult. We'll also ask her about her brother, RFK Jr.'s presidential campaign. Stay tuned for that conversation next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A new documentary looks at the rise and fall of Synanon. That's a group that began as a drug treatment center here in California in Santa Monica, but evolved into a cult. Synanon began in 1958 when society really viewed drug addiction as a hopeless struggle, kind of like a life sentence.
We face a growing menace called drug addiction. Every citizen must be made to realize that drug addiction is a very real threat.
Once a drug addict, always a drug addict. And they said it so many times, the drug addicts, we believe that ourselves.
However, the founder, Charles Diederich, drawing from his experience with Alcoholics Anonymous, really challenged this notion, and he established a refuge where addicts could find solace and support.
Sin and I was in a storefront, and when an addict came in, they were put on the couch, and they were not left alone until they kicked.
Well, it was initially praised for its groundbreaking approach to drug treatment, but Synanon later took a dark turn. The organization's dissent included weapons caches, coercing vasectomies for its male members, using children as forced labor, and on and on. Joining us is Emmy Award-winning documentarian Rory Kennedy. She's the director and producer of a new documentary series called The Synanon Fix, currently on HBO and streaming on Max, and that's where those clips are from. Hi, Rory.
Hi, Madeline.
All right. Way back, it began in 1958 in Santa Monica, and what was the original idea?
The original idea of Synanon was really the brainchild of its founder, Chuck Diederich. And Chuck had been an alcoholic. He had spent a lot of years going to AA, but he also was frustrated and felt like there was a limitation to AA where people would tell their stories, but then there was no opportunity to question them or challenge them. And in many of the meetings he went to, he didn't feel like necessarily people were genuine or totally honest in their telling. And so he started these meetings at his place on Ocean Park here in Santa Monica, where he would have AA meetings, but where you could confront people. And you could, frankly, scream at people. Drug addicts started coming in, and they stayed, and they really liked it, and they stayed off of drugs. And they asked if they could spend the night, and he had these couches, and he said, you can spend the night, and you can stay here, but I don't really have anything. And so, and you guys don't know how to do much other than to hustle, so go out and hustle for beds and for food and for donations, which they did, and it expanded, and it became quite successful as a place that kept drug addicts off of drugs in the early years where there was really no other opportunities for drug addicts. There was really the only place for them to go was to mental health hospitals or to jail, or they would die.
Wow. You described this unorthodox treatment method where people would confront each other and scream at each other, and they called that the game. Let me just play a little clip of tape, because there's lots of tape. They seem to have recorded themselves incessantly. And so let me play a little clip from one game.
You are a minimum daily mother.
That is
where is that?
That is
not, I know that when you leave the job,
not, I
you are going.
Do it.
No, you are going to grow up, you old.
Okay, so people would scream at each other like that, and that was effective. Like, why did that work?
Well, aren't you tempted by it? you know, I think it's interesting because, of course, that was a question that I asked everybody who I interviewed of why did it work? And some people said they didn't know, but it just somehow changed the way that they went through the world. And I think other people talked about how, you know, a lot of them had shame and a lot of issues that hadn't been talked about that were eating away at them. And when they had an outlet to actually talk to people about it and to be confronted and be forced to talk about it, it was this kind of relief and this lightness. And as a result, they weren't driven to continue to use drugs to try to cover up those emotions.
Mm-hmm.
You had a bed to sleep on and you had food. You didn't, you know, have to go get out and get a job. There were kind of jobs within Synanon. A lot of the daily challenges of life were taken out of the equation for them. So I think those stresses also got minimized.
Mm.
course, they started accepting children as well, so people didn't have to be separated from their children, and they started living at Synanon. You know, there's all of these amazing photographs in those early years with these little kids in the foreground and people on the kicking couch, which they called it. Whenever you, when somebody new would come in, they would just go to this couch and they would kick their habit. And there was a puke bucket.
I remember emptying puke buckets and getting cold rags. It was completely normal, completely natural. It was our living room.
And these kids are running around and, you know, they're clearing the puke bucket and they're hanging out with these drug addicts.
These kids live there. And then they also had to be in the game amongst themselves, which just, you have a clip of that. And it really seems like a Lord of the Flies situation and a total, an entirely different situation when children are screaming at each other. Why did they encourage kids to play the game?
You know, this, of course, is the thing about Synanon, which is that there were a lot of good ideas, but then they were taken to an extreme. But you see it in the beginning. And in fact, it's in episode one where there are these young children who are playing the game with each other. And Billy, who was the man who was just speaking there, I think talks really beautifully about, you know, he felt like he was pretty equipped to play the game, but watching friends of his, and you see it in the footage, and it's, you know, it's just gut-wrenching where you see these little kids who are crying and they're being screamed at, and you feel that they really haven't been given the tools to navigate this terrain.
Wow.
You know, I think with Synanon, there's so many extreme things that happened, and that there was a concern that the telling of it would be very sensationalist and would really focus on those things exclusively. Truthfully, that was very much available. But ultimately, you know, what we felt is that particularly in those early years, there was something that was truly forward-thinking and ahead of its time and has had, in some respect, a very positive legacy. You know, most of the drug treatment programs that you know today, like Phoenix House, a lot of the big ones, you can trace their origin to Synanon. There's a legacy that came out of Synanon that is very positive. And so it was important to us in the telling of this to really capture those early years. It was also very forward-thinking in terms of interracial relationships. And I mean, like one of the people we talked to, Buddy, who's an African-American who was recruited by San Diego State, he was told by his friends, when it gets intense, make your way to Synanon. And he talks about walking through the doors at Synanon. It was the first time he ever felt like he was in a place anytime, anywhere in America where there was no racism, you know? And of course, Chuck, who was white, was married to Betty, who was African-American. So the kind of, you know, the people that everybody admired and looked up to were an interracial couple. And in those early years, Chuck went to jail because in Santa Monica at the time, there was a lot of resistance, not only to, you know, a facility that was housing ex-drug addicts, but also, frankly, because it was interracial and people didn't like it. I mean, 58, there was still, you see these in the footage of the film, you know, there was segregation on the beach of where African-Americans could lie on the beach in Santa Monica and where white people were afforded to go. So it kind of takes you back to this time that's really fascinating, and you really see the potential of this facility and the vision of it and how fantastic it was. And so by the end, it falls apart.
You know, it definitely is emblematic of the 60s and the idealism of the 60s turning sour in the 70s, right? And something that has happened in all spheres of public life in the 60s, of which your family is intimately a part of. So I'm wondering if that is one reason why you were attracted to the telling of this, because it does kind of illustrate a chapter of history that is also a personal chapter for you and the Kennedy family.
Yes, I think that was definitely part of my interest in it. There was something fascinating to me about, I mean, in those early years where they were so successful, and it was termed the miracle on the beach in a number of articles. There was focus from international media. Presidents commented on, you know, how wonderful this program was. People talk about it went from focusing on drug users to opening it up to what they called squares.
The lifestylers.
Were people who were not drug addicts and who just wanted to come in and be part of the community and play the game. A number of those people, and they were sort of coming in the mid to late 60s, and many of those people talked about how they were driven there by what was happening in politics in the United States and the disappointments and, you know, the assassinations, and wanting to look to find an alternative to what they were seeing in society. And that Synanon felt like it was, you know, it was taking this big swing at something that was better and was an alternative model to what was happening in society. You know, I think one of the reasons we were attracted to this story is because I think you see that today, right, where people are being drawn to charismatic personalities because, and I think this happens when there's times where it feels like there's uncertainty in society. And there's like a feeling that of groundlessness, and that people are looking for different kinds of leaderships and models, because what they're seeing ahead of them is disappointing.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Rory Kennedy. She's an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker. Her latest is a new 4-part series called The Synanon Fix, currently on HBO and streaming on Max. Well, you know, I was going to ask you about this, but you've provided an opening to talk about it now, and that is your brother and his candidacy for the presidency. And he is attracting that, too. When I read what his supporters say, they very much echo what you're saying, that they're looking for something different, that they're looking for a way to shake up the system, that they're looking for someone outside the mainstream who has views that aren't necessarily orthodox, but that dovetail with theirs when it comes to suspicion of major institutions like, you know, the Democratic Party or the pharmaceutical industry or, you know, vaccines, all of that. And I know you have come out against his candidacy, as have some other members of your family. But how do you think about that in the context of what you just said?
You know, I think one of the things I've learned in making this series is that, you know, charisma can be a good thing, but it's not necessarily a good thing. You know, charisma draws people towards that source, in this case, leadership. Charisma can come in the form of Nelson Mandela, or it can come in the form of Hitler, right? And and so I think.
And where's your brother in that continuum?
I think that, you know, I think the point with both Trump and with Bobby is that you really have to understand where that person is taking you, and not be guided by pure charisma. And so I think everybody, because, you know, and I don't want to dismiss people in either camp, but I do think we all have to question, where is this person taking us, and do they really represent my beliefs? Answering those questions, I think, is good for all of us to do.
Yeah. But do you think the candidacy of your brother, or your brother, do you see him as a a dangerous element to in the current environment?
Well, I think that we're up against the most important election of our lifetime. I think that it is going to come down to a handful of votes in a handful of states. And from the polls that I am seeing with Bobby, he is taking a lot more votes from Biden. And I think it's going to be a very tight election. And so my concern is that in voting for Bobby, you're voting for Trump. And I think personally that Trump is very scary and is very dangerous and would be catastrophic to have him back in office. I don't want to come out against my brother. I love Bobby, but you know, particularly when he decided to run as an independent, which directly takes votes away from Biden, and he has our family name, I feel compelled to speak out, because I think if people who aren't necessarily looking into what his positions are and what the implications of his campaign are, that they, if I don't speak out, would naturally assume that he represents the views of our family, given his both his first name and his last name. Mm-hmm. And I, as a result, feel compelled to say that he does not represent my views and that I am deeply concerned about his candidacy.
Do you think he's actually running to win or running to be a disruptor?
I think probably his intention is to win. It's, you know, very hard in this country to run as a third party candidate and actually win. As we all know, you have to get 270 delegates. And even if you can win a significant number of the popular vote, that doesn't mean that you get any delegates, because you have to do it state by state and you have to win the majority in that state. And then if nobody wins the 270, then the decision goes to the House. So I don't see any scenario where he could actually win. And I think if you look at the numbers and the statistics and people who look at them come to the same conclusion, it's virtually impossible to win. Yeah. So however charismatic he is, and then looking at his actual numbers, he's not even close to that. So that's the concern, is that he just, you know, he takes more votes from Biden. And even mm-hmm. if it's 1 or 2%, that's kind of the margins that we're talking about. And so that can very easily in this handful of swing states push Trump to be the victor. Those are the stakes. Everybody should know.
Okay, let's get back to the movie then. We know your views are very clear about your brother's candidacy. So as we said, this thing has goes south, right? It's like the 60s, all that idealism and, I don't know, free love and all that comes to a kind of a dark end. And this is when you mentioned the squares and the lifestylers getting involved in Synanon. So they kind of pushed aside the people who are addicted to drugs. And Chuck Diederich, the founder of Synanon, focuses on them instead. And is that when he gets, I don't know, more of kind of a God complex, where he feels like, and becomes more like a cult leader?
Yeah, I would say that's definitely a significant moment. And the question does come up, kind of what was the turning point with Chuck, where it kind of goes from this, you know, really effective, celebrated drug treatment program, interracial, you know, progressive ideals, to something much darker. And I don't think that I can isolate it to a singular moment. I think opening it up to squares definitely changed the dynamic and kind of started this real sense that Chuck started embodying this kind of cult-like leader and was treated as such. Then there was it kind of evolved or devolved into forced vasectomies and abortions, head shaving, and ultimately a What really, really marked the end is the IRS coming in and taking away their nonprofit status. And then they had to pay back millions and millions of dollars in taxes, and as a result had to basically sell all of their buildings and assets. And that was kind of the official demise.
So Synanon eventually loses much of its power. When it comes to its treatment model and how it helped addicts or not, was it effective when the people who were addicted to drugs tried to leave or left to resume normal life? Did they stay clean?
Well, you know, some clearly did, because we talked to a number of people who had gone through Synanon and were still clean, you know, 45, 50 years later. And then others didn't fare as well. So I think it's, you know, similar to what you have today when people go to drug treatment programs. Chuck had kind of initially had a vision of people staying for a shorter period of time and then going back out into the world. And then he either observed that when those people went out into the world, they started using again, or he became increasingly invested in keeping people in the program. He kind of somewhere between a mandated and strongly recommended that people come to Synanon and stay forever, really. And, you know, for those people who stayed, that they largely stayed clean. They didn't track it. But, you know, listen, to its credit, there really was nothing before Synanon to deal with the heroin addicts and this crisis that was hitting America's streets at the time. And, you know, it was really a godsend for not just these individuals, but the families who were grappling with this issue and really felt like there was nothing, out there for them.
Hmm. Rory Kennedy is the producer and director of The Synanon Fix, a four-part documentary series on HBO and streaming on Max. Thanks, Rory.
Thank you. Always great talking to you, Madeline.
Coming up, we'll go back to the RFK Jr. topic. We'll find out just how big a problem his candidacy is for Democrats and what they're doing about it.
The DNC saying, hey, you might know him from all this advocacy, but listen, he's not who he was maybe 20 years ago, and he really poses a threat to the president.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We just heard from RFK Jr.'s sister, Rory Kennedy, about her concerns that his campaign will hurt President Joe Biden. And she is not alone. The Democratic National Committee is going after Kennedy directly. And Trump's top PAC donor, Tim Mellon, is also RFK's top PAC donor, in a likely bid to undercut Biden. And this week, a leaked recording surfaced of RFK staffer Rita Palma speaking to Trump voters in New York.
So right now, the way that I see it, the Kennedy voter and the Trump voter, our mutual enemy is Biden. My thoughts are most of the Northeast is going to go blue. Why wouldn't we put our vote to Bobby, thereby reducing Biden's 270?
RFK has disavowed that statement and says it doesn't represent his campaign and that he wants voters from both the Trump and Biden camps. We're going to talk about this now with Eva McCann, who's been covering RFK Jr.'s campaign for CNN. Hello.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so what did you make of that leaked recording? What did it reveal to you in terms of the campaign strategy of RFK Jr.? I know that she doesn't work directly with strategy. She's kind of ancillary in terms of being a staffer. But did it reveal something about what they want to do?
Well, it is certainly problematic for them because they have been trying to consistently make the case that they aren't meant to spoil one side in particular, that this isn't a crusade against President Biden, that they want to pull together a coalition of voters on the right and the left. But here you have a person who is on their campaign, right? She has a Team Kennedy email address. She identified herself as the campaign's New York State director, although they downplayed her role, saying she was merely a ballot access consultant. But you have this woman going so far as to say New York Republicans should go to Pennsylvania to help Trump. So it is deeply problematic for their campaign, and it's not the message that they want to be putting out there at this time.
What is the message they want to be putting out there? Who do they want to attract?
I would say people who are feeling disaffected on both sides. And that was really evident, I think, in Kennedy's very convoluted statement on where he stood on January 6th. He both called former President Donald Trump delusional, but at the same time, he seemed to voice empathy for the defendants in that case. And so it was strained in a way. And I think in many instances, he runs into that, this sort of strain, because he is trying to be, I think, as appealing to as possible to as many voters as possible. And there is a market for third parties right now, because no one wants to see, the voters I speak to as I travel the country want to see this rematch between Biden and Trump. So what you have are third party candidates doing their best to do this delicate dance to appeal to as many voters as possible.
And where is he polling in general? He's in the double digits, right?
Yeah, in some places around 10% routinely. And so when you think about the battleground states where President Biden in some instances won by just a few thousand votes, it could be incredibly consequential. He has shown the most strong polling among any third party candidates in this contest at this stage.
So how seriously is the Biden team taking this as a threat?
They're taking it very seriously. I would say more so than Republicans. The former president's team have come out with comments, statements that characterize Kennedy as too far to the left and as a left-wing extremist. But you aren't really seeing them build up a whole operation on the right. Well, it's a much different story on the left. Not only does the DNC, as you mentioned, Liz Smith and others on her team, working daily, putting out negative information about Kennedy, but in addition to that, you have a myriad of left-wing interest groups that are also working overtime to try to tank essentially his campaign, challenge his ballot access in a number of states. He described it as his campaign is drinking from a fire hose right now, essentially. Democrats are trying to make it as hard as they can for Kennedy to remain viable.
Okay, so you said you talked to supporters of his, and they come from all areas of the political spectrum, correct? So you've got the left-leaning Democratic groups trying to prevent him from winning or being on the ballot in some of these states. But some of his supporters are pretty left-wing, right? These kind of new age wellness types?
They are. Actually, when I was in Oakland for his rollout of his vice presidential running mate a few weeks ago, a lot of the people I spoke to said that they voted for President Biden in 2020. And listen, Kennedy has been a longtime environmentalist, and so there are people on the left that know him from that space. He's very big in the regenerative agriculture space, and that attracts a lot of folks on the left as well. And I think now what we see is the DNC, other organizations on the left saying, hey, you might know him from all this advocacy, but listen, he's not who he was maybe 20 years ago. And he really poses a threat to the president.
And also his anti-vaccine stance, right? I mean, he's likened the COVID vaccines to the Holocaust. I mean, he's made some pretty outrageous statements when it comes to vaccines. Some of these voters are attracted to that.
They are. I would say, though, it is not the central focus of his campaign. And when you talk to voters like online lined up to get into an event, they'll name a whole host of issues, whether it be the economy, the environment. It's not always vaccines.
Right. Who is he pulling from the right? Why would MAGA Republicans be attracted to him?
Well, I think some of those, actually, the woman who identified herself as the state director, she talks about in that leaked video why she was attracted to the campaign. And she said it was the vaccine issue. But also, I think those on the right who feel as though they are anti-establishment and are feeling as though former President Donald Trump has just too much baggage and is too much of a liability.
Interesting. And he is on the ballot now, I think, in precisely one state, Utah. So it's going to be an uphill battle for him to get on the ballot in all 50 states.
Well, I don't know. I think that they have a pretty sophisticated operation in trying to pursue that effort. At least that's what they are telegraphing. And keep in mind, they are going to submit their signatures in the final hour to give people as little time as possible to challenge them. So I wouldn't count them out in terms of the ballot access mobilization quite yet. And then he also has named this running mate who is extraordinarily wealthy. And she has said that she is going to be aggressively making sure over the next several months that he gets on the ballot in every state.
Interesting. Eva McCann, national political correspondent for CNN. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a local mom talks about her efforts to stock school libraries with LGBTQ-themed books. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. School districts across the United States banned more than 4,000 books last year. That's according to the American Library Association. Nearly half of those books dealt with racial or LGBTQ topics. Here in California, the Temecula Unified School District tried to censor a textbook that included a lesson on Harvey Milk, the San Francisco gay rights icon who was assassinated back in 1978. And in response last year, California enacted a law that forbids school boards from banning books that cover these topics. Well, it's one thing not to ban, and yet another thing to make sure the books on these topics, LGBTQ topics in particular, are on the shelves. So an organization called Open Books donates books they describe as LGBTQ affirming to public schools, including to every elementary campus in LAUSD. Morgan Walsh co-founded Open Books with her friend Keiko Feldman, and Morgan joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. So happy to be here.
Great to have you. All right. So take us back to the beginning, because it was many, many years ago before this whole controversy with Temecula, et cetera, happened, when you decided to begin this organization and what prompted it?
Sure. So I'm a mom of three, and I just learned very quickly there wasn't a lot of space for imaginative play, especially when it came to boys maybe playing with dolls or wearing dresses. And I started a Facebook page to connect with other families, and I was asking for people to share their stories, you know, even living in a place as seemingly progressive as Los Angeles, just surprised at how difficult people find gender nonconformity.
And so how do you get the books, and how do you choose which books to donate?
So the list that we donate has been officially endorsed by the Human Rights Campaign, by HRC. All of the books that we donate are age-appropriate and acclaimed books. We try to make sure that each of the books represents a part of this human experience of being LGBTQ, either a family or, you know, a bird that can't find its flock or a mislabeled crayon. You know, it's all the feelings associated with feeling other in your society.
What kind of pushback have you encountered, if any? This, as you say, this started 6 years ago. The controversy over this kind of stuff has only increased since then.
Yeah, it's wild. And obviously, as you mentioned, we started doing this before that was the case. We really felt like we were fulfilling an organic need. You know, if these books were newish, and so we thought, oh, the libraries are certainly going to want them. Why don't we help fill that need? So that's the place from which we started this. And the pushback we've received, it varies. There are some districts that we reach out to that don't even respond. There are also districts that we've donated to that have really surprised us, that we assumed there'd be just no way in. But the truth is, we've quickly realized these are educators. They're the boots on the ground. They see the kids hiding in the libraries at lunchtime. They know their students, and they're also committed to having a well-rounded library in their school, because that's just a really basic part of education, is to make sure all different kinds of stories are represented in a library. Certainly in the United States, that's important. So we've received less pushback than one might think, but we also are a small organization pushing this boulder uphill. You know, maybe if we were actively pursuing districts in Texas and in Florida, or some of these other places, which we have made inroads, but if we were really, really trying, we might see more pushback.
But wouldn't those areas be the ones where the need would be greatest?
You'd think so, right? The truth is, the messaging is pervasive right now. But yes, we would love to be in these districts where there's really no positive messaging. There are kids who don't get any positive messaging at home and don't get any positive messaging at school. And that is just heartbreaking. It's actually also heartbreaking for all students. That's something that's very important to us behind our reasoning in donating these books, is that we firmly believe they don't just benefit kids who identify as LGBTQ at all. They benefit all students.
Right. And these are in elementary schools, right? So it's a story of two penguins. It's not, it's like anyone can read the story. It's not just for a particular child.
Yes. It's too... acknowledge that there are all kinds of feelings. The human experience is vast, and that's a beautiful thing that this country is made up of so many different kinds of people. And the fact of the matter is, there are LGBTQ kids in every single school in this country. And the choice is whether you help them feel okay about themselves, help them feel valued and loved, or you actively hurt them.
Why do you think the story of Harvey Milk in particular is something that some school administrators are particularly sensitive about?
I don't know, except for to say that the cover of the book that I'm familiar with, Harvey Milk and the Story of the Rainbow Flag, has a big pride flag on it. You know, it's a little more maybe overtly LGBTQ, and there's also some mention of him being assassinated, which has been a concern with the district we've dealt with before. We've had lots of leaders, unfortunately, who've been assassinated, and Harvey Milk is an important leader I know I didn't learn about when I was in school.
Are there some topics or some books that you can kind of see why administrators might be a little leery of approaching or having on their shelves?
Well, it's a complicated answer. If I put myself into the shoes of a school administrator who is fearfully anticipating any and all extreme opinions coming back at them, then sure, I can dive in and imagine things that would set people off, because I've been absolutely shocked at the things that set people off. But I can say there's a wonderful book. It was a bestseller, originally titled George, written by one of our favorite authors, Alex Gino. It is now rightfully called Melissa. It was actually published under the character's dead name, George. And Alex made a campaign in more recent years to get it republished. And it has been now. But there's a reference in that book that had some school administrators concerned, but it's very opaque. And it actually refers to a kid looking at girly magazines. That's the sentence, I believe. Mm-hmm. But it's also one of the most read books. I mean, we went to visit a school, we donated it to, a year or so after we'd made the donation. And we saw that the copy was really like brand new. It looked pristine. Keiko, my co-founder, she said, oh, so no one's getting this book. And the librarian said, oh, no, that book has been checked out so much we had to order a new copy.
Oh, wow. What is it about that book that is so popular, do you think?
When we see in a book our feelings reflected back to us, regardless of who we are, that is a universal experience of like, okay, I've seen myself in this person, in this book, and it's a great comfort.
That's Morgan Walsh, co-founder of Open Books. That's a nonprofit that distributes LGBTQ inclusive books to public schools. Morgan, thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
And that will do it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget to follow us on the socials. We are at KCRW. I am at The Mad Brand. And you can also download and subscribe to the Press Play podcast. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I am Madeline Brand, and I'll see you back here again tomorrow.